Well, hello and welcome back to the Archaeology News Weekly. Yes, it's me, David Connolly, your jovial host, as they say. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now, the main headlines from around the world are as follows. We start off with a Bronze Age shipwreck found off the Devon coast. And then the exciting news that a new tool to improve the accuracy of radiocarbon dating has been created, dating back 50,000 years. A new report shows that sea levels were erratic during the last ice age. And could Neanderthals live again? It's the big question, both scientifically and ethically. Scrub clearance on old serum. Reasons for and against, we look at them both. And Stone Age Siberian settled in Greenland. This changes the idea of settlement patterns. And now, here's a new thing. Arbor glyphs, ancient tree carvings in California. Stonehenge, yes, it's back in the news again. The proposed centre is heavily criticised. Well, there's a surprise. And less controversially, an 8,000-year-old skeleton, is unearthed in Malaysia. Back to Stonehenge, or is it Stonehedge? And we end with a report about a Danish bog woman given a face. One of the world's oldest shipwrecks has been discovered off the coast of Devon in England after lying on the seabed for almost 3,000 years. The trading vessel was carrying an extremely valuable cargo of tin and hundreds of copper ingots from the continent when it sank. Experts say the incredibly exciting discovery provides new evidence about the extent and sophistication of Britain's links with Europe in the Bronze Age, as well as the remarkable seafaring abilities of the people during the period. Archaeologists have described the vessel, which is thought to date back to around 900 BCE, as being a bulk carrier of its age. The copper and tin would have been used for making bronze. Archaeologists believe the copper, and possibly the tin, was being imported into Britain and originated in a number of different countries throughout Europe, rather than from a single source, demonstrating the existence of a complex network of trade routes across the continent. Academics at the University of Oxford are carrying out further analysis of the cargo in order to establish its exact origins. However, it's thought that the copper would have come from the Iberian Peninsula, Alpine Europe, and possibly other locations in France, such as the Massif Central, and even as far as Austria. It's the first time tin ingots from this period have ever been found in Britain, a discovery which may support theories that the metal was being mined in the southwest at the time. If the tin was not produced in Britain, it's likely to have come from the Iberian Peninsula as well, or perhaps from eastern Germany. The wreck has been found in just 8 to 10 metres of water in the bay near Salcombe in South Devon by a team of amateur marine archaeologists from the South West Marine Archaeological Group. The cargo recovered includes 259 copper ingots and 27 tin ingots. Also found was a bronze leaf sword, two stone artifacts that could have been slingshots, and three golden wrist torques, or bracelets. The team has yet to uncover any of the vessel's structure, which is likely to have eroded away. However, experts believe it could have been up to 40 foot long and up to 6 foot wide, and been constructed of planks of timber on a wooden frame with a hide hull. It would have had a crew of around about 15 and been powered by paddles. Mick Palmer, chairman of the Southwest Marine Archaeological Group, said that there is more down there and we will carry on searching for it. We anticipate a lot more will be found. One other Bronze Age vessel has previously been found near Salcombe, where just 53 artefacts were recovered. Another 8 bronze items have been found at a third nearby spot, indicating another possible wreck. Well, there you go. You wait for one, then three come along at once. Researchers at Queen's University in Northern Ireland have helped produce a new archaeological tool which could answer key questions in human evolution. The new calibration curve, which extends back 50,000 years, is a major landmark in radiocarbon dating. It could help research issues including the effects of climate change on human adaptation and migration. The project was led by Queen's University Belfast through a National Environment Research Centre funded research grant to Paula Raymer and Professor Jerry McCormack from the Centre for Climate and Statisticians at the University of Sheffield. The curve, called INTCAL-09, not only extends radiocarbon calibration but also considerably improves earlier parts of the curve. It's taken nearly 30 years for researchers to produce a calibration curve this far back in time. Most experts consider the technical limit of radiocarbon dating to be around 50,000 years, after which there's too little carbon-14 left to measure accurately with present-day technology. Further information on the work at Queen's Chrono Centre can be found online at chrono.qub.ac.uk. That was chrono.qub.ac.uk. Cave formations along the coast of an island in the Mediterranean Sea hold evidence that sea level can rise and fall abruptly during an ice age, a finding that casts some doubt on current notions about how those lengthy cold spells develop and progress. Jeffrey Dural, a paleoclimatologist at the University of Iowa, stated that at the height of the ice age, immense volumes of water are locked up in land-based ice sheets, and ocean levels can be as much as 130 metres below where they are today. By contrast, when the ice melts during warm periods, sea level can be a few metres higher than modern-day standard. Now, Dural and his colleagues report that during a brief interval, well within the most recent ice age, sea level suddenly and inexplicably rose to a height more than 1 metre above today's. Evidence supporting that conclusion comes from cave formations on the Spanish island of Mallorca. As sea levels rose and fell, water sloshing into the coastal caves left crusts of minerals on their walls and floors, as well as on the existing cave formations. Radioisotope dating of mineral crusts in one cave along Mallorca's southern coast indicates that sea level salt, about 1.5 metres higher than today, between 110,000 until 10,000 years ago. Similar analysis of samples from nearby caves show that between 80,000 and 82,000 years ago, sea level ranged between 1.25 metres and 1.6 metres above today's standard. Well, looks like we're doomed, whether it's global warming or an ice age. Now, researchers are closer than ever having a first draft of a complete sequence of the genome of a Neanderthal woman who lived some 30,000 years ago. And this means that one day it may be possible to create a living person from the DNA sequence. The fragments of DNA from bones of a Neanderthal woman who died in a cave in what is now Croatia were assembled using human and chimpanzee genomes as reference. Researcher Gerald Erzik said that putting the fragments in order is difficult because at first it seems like a random assemblage of the nucleotide bases. That's easy for him to say. But there are patterns and motifs that are often specific to a group of organisms, creating body parts, organs, and even a complete living individual once the genome is completely sequenced would be difficult, but it is theoretically possible. Chief Science Officer of Advanced Cell Technology Robert Lanza said that species such as cows and goats are now routinely cloned with few problems. And while there are many more challenges in the case of cloning a Neanderthal, it possibly could be done. The ethics, though, of such a move would be certain to spark a great deal of debate, and not just between paleoanthropologists. However, it's likely to be quite some time before we need to deal with such an ethical issue. Mapping the genome should allow scientists to answer questions about the relationships between us and Neanderthals, such as whether we interbred and were a separate species. Shake hands with a Neanderthal? However, we should remember that this is a person, mind you, who would hardly be able to remember mammoth hunting, so we'd actually have to ask exactly what would be the purpose of cloning a Neanderthal. Anyway, I'm sure this is going to be something beyond my lifetime. English Heritage has hit back at criticism of its management of Old Sarum in England, continuing as a fresh round of scrub clearance gets underway, and it's confirmed that no new trees will be allowed to grow there. The work has upset campaigner Mo Vines, who has accused the organisation of getting rid of our future by felling yew and beech saplings and holly bushes. It will end up like Figsbury, she says, just dead. She wants to see variety and diversity. English Heritage, however, says that it is trying to preserve the embankments, which are being damaged by tree roots, by grass being shaded out on the surface, and by rabbits. Its ultimate aim is to restore the monument's original character as unimproved chalk grassland, and has the backing of Wiltshire Wildlife Trust. Archaeologist Julian Richards, who is drawing up a management plan for the site, said he was recommending a lot more scrub clearance. Primarily, Old Sarum is not a nature reserve, it's a nationally important ancient monument, and English Heritage holds it in guardianship for the nation. Julian Richards is recommending that English Heritage form a Friends of Old Sarum group to involve the community in its future care. A 4,000-year-old Greenland man has just entered the scientific debate over the origins of prehistoric populations in the Americas. A nearly complete sequence of nuclear DNA extracted from strands of the long-dead man's hair, the first such sequence obtained from an ancient person, highlights a previously unknown and relatively recent migration of northeastern Asians into the New World about 5,500 years ago. Greenland's first known settlers were not Inuit or Native Americans as widely believed, but the direct descendants of Siberians who somehow crossed the Bering Strait to Alaska and then headed east, according to this new report. Because the hair was found in permafrost, it has been very and well preserved. The scientists already know from studying the remains of woolly mammoths that hair is a particularly good source of uncontaminated DNA. Geneticist Morten Rasmussen reported that an analysis of differences or mutations at single base pairs on the ancient Greenlander's nuclear genome indicates that his father's ancestors came from northeastern Siberia. Three modern hunter-gatherer groups in that region, the Nagasans, the Koryaks and the Chukchiks, display a closer genetic link to the Greenland individual than Native American groups living in cold northern areas of the Americas. A largely complete mitochondrial DNA sequence from the ancient man's hair, extracted by the same researchers in 2008, places his maternal ancestry in northeastern Asia as well. Danish-led excavations more than 20 years ago unearthed four fragmentary bones and several hair tufts belonging to this ancient man, dubbed Inuk. His remains were found at a site from the Sakak culture, the earliest known people to have inhabited Greenland. Sakak people lived in Greenland from around 4,750 to 2,500 years ago. One popular hypothesis traces Sakak ancestry to Native American groups that had settled Arctic parts of Alaska and Canada by 11,000 years ago. Inuk's strong genetic ties to Siberian populations, though, raise a different scenario. The team's new comparative analysis of Inuk's previously sequenced mitochondrial DNA indicates that the Sakaks diverged from their closest present-day relatives, Siberian Chukchiks. Chukchiks, an estimated 5,500 years ago. That calculation implies the ancestral Sakaks separated from their Asian relatives shortly before departing to the New World and rapidly traversing the continent to reach Greenland. No land bridge connected Asia to North America at the time, so migrants probably crossed the Bering Strait from what is now Russia to Alaska by boat. As to why the group should head towards Greenland, where it's permanently cold rather than the balmier climes further south, is a good question, they say. It could be that more favourable land for settlement was already occupied by rivals, or perhaps they were just used to the Arctic. There's still no clear answer to it. Now, we all know about rock art, but what about tree art? On the trunk of a gnarled centuries-old oak tree about 90 miles southwest of Phoenix, Arizona, are odd carvings of six-legged lizard-like beings. The tree is located at Painted Rock, an archaeological site peppered with hundreds of ancient petroglyphs, images created on rock surfaces. Known as the Scorpion Tree, locals have long believed that cowboys were behind the tree carvings. The technical term is arborglyph. But paleontologist Rex Santonge knew it dated to long before them. His analysis offers a glimpse not only into the cultural history of the Chumash people, the Native American tribe that once inhabited the region, it also provides unique insights into their scientific expertise. Although Santonge is uncertain how old the tree carving is, he believes that nearby Chumash residents may have maintained it until the early 20th century. The arborglyph led Santonge to connect the symbols within the carvings with the stars in the sky. After spending more time at the site, Santonge realized that the carved crown in its relation to one of the spheres was strikingly similar to the way that the constellation Ursa Major related to the position of Polaris, the North Star. He quickly learned that the constellation could be used to tell the seasons and that the Chumash people also revered the astronomical relationship in their language and cosmology. It became increasingly obvious to Saint-Ange that the arborglyph and related cave paintings weren't just the work of wild-eyed, drug-induced shamans. which has been a leading theory for decades, but that the ancient images were deliberate studies of the stars and served as an integral component of the Chumash people's annual calendar. Well, you can actually read more about the Chumash and the excellent Windwolves project in the latest edition of Past Horizons magazine, which is online now, but more of that at the end of this podcast. Its footpaths are torturous, the roof likely to channel wind and rain, and its myriad columns, meant to evoke a forest, are incongruous with the vast landscape surrounding it, so says the government's design watchdog over plans for the controversial £20 million visitor centre at Stonehenge, the megalithic jewel in England's cultural crown. CABE, the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment, has criticised the design of the proposed centre, claiming the futuristic building by Denton Corker Marshall does little to enhance the 5,000-year-old standing stones, which attract more than 800,000 visitors each year. Its concerns are the latest chapter in the long saga surrounding the English Heritage Back project and follow a government decision 2 years ago to scrap on cost ground a highly ambitious £65 million scheme to build a tunnel to reroute traffic and protect the World Heritage Site. The centre, which has been approved by Wiltshire County Council planners, has divided opinion, and I feel it will do for many, many years to come. Archaeologists have stumbled upon human skeletal remains believed to be from the Mesolithic period in Bewa Cave in the Kenyir Lake area of Malaysia. The remains, believed to be that of a youth, are estimated to be between 8,000 to 11,000 years old. DNA samples from the remains have been sent to the United States for analysis, and the results are expected later this month. DNA seems to be all the rage just now. Anyway, back to Stonehenge. Stonehenge may have been surrounded by a hedge that blocked onlookers from seeing secret rituals, according to a new study. Evidence for two encircling hedges, possibly made of thorn bushes planted some 3,600 years ago, was uncovered during a survey of the site by English Heritage. The idea that Stonehenge... You heard me there? Yes, you knew I was going to say that. Was a shield against prying eye isn't firmly rooted yet. Oh, I'm sorry, I've done that again. But is the archaeologist's best theory. The newfound banks are too low and unsubstantial to have had a defensive role, so the most likely theory is some sort of hedge bank. While there's no firm evidence for a prehistoric landscape gardening tradition, there's evidence for tree cultivation at the time that Stonehenge was in use. It seems that standard-sized trees were being cultivated and tended in order to provide straight telegraph pole-like posts for the construction of palisades. With that in mind, stone hedges, vegetation screen, is quite feasible, with something like thorn bushes or small trees. Past archaeological investigations at Stonehenge have tended to focus chiefly on the stones themselves, but to date nobody has really considered the vegetation that would have been present around the stones. And finally, the female known as Onning Woman, found in northeastern Jutland Bog in 1886 and housed at the Museum for Culture and History in Kanders in Denmark, has finally got a face. Reasonably well preserved when she popped up out of the bog, the woman's 2,000-year-old skull was broken into several pieces. But sculptor Bjorn Skarup and medical examiner Niels Linnerup from the Panum Institute in Copenhagen have now reconstructed the Onning Woman's face using common forensic clay method. The finished product was put on display today at the museum, and although the results have shown her to be neither attractive nor particularly ugly, a reproduction of her face that is as close to reality as it's come can now be viewed by all. Experts believe the woman was killed as a sacrifice. With a plastic copy of the body's skull, and knowing the sex and approximate age of the deceased, the pair is able to determine the general shape of the head and face, including the size of the nose and mouth. Skarup first created the model's muscles and tendons with the help of Linnerup as a kind of medical advisor. Then each layer of skill is added and moulded into shape. Linnerup admitted, however, that there is no way to know what a person's ears and hair looked like without a sample. Eyebrows, eye colour, wrinkles and other features such as that would be difficult to recreate as well. Well, I hope somebody does that to me one day and there's a better job than I look just now. So, as I promised, more news about the Past Horizons magazine, Adventures in Archaeology. The latest edition, issue 11, is out right now with some incredible stories ranging from the Maya Research Project to Lofotr Museum up in the Lofoten Islands in northern Norway. We also have a report from, as I said, the Windwolves Project in California. And, well, why not just go along and read the magazine? You'll be able to find it at www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. Can I also remind you that there are many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the amazing heritage calendar, library, guidance section, and, well, lots more. At Badger, www.bajr.org. And more can always be found, as ever, at Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. Thank you for listening to this week's Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return again next week.